This piece is called One Night. One night, I was waiting for the bus. Then this station wagon with about six white dudes drives by and yells, "Hey, chink!" So I stick my middle finger up their ass and the car turns around. And I kept saying to myself, "Hey, I ain't Chinese, I'm Japanese." And my heart was pounding faster and faster, and the blood inside of me and got hotter. And then when they finally caught me, there were so many feet and hands that I wished my sensei was here to help me out. But then this carload of black dudes pulls over and starts kicking the out of these white dudes until they all run off. This one black dude helped me up, I remember, because my blood got on his hands, and they gave me a ride home, and I said, "Hey, thanks for helping me out." And as he drove off, one said, "Anytime, chink!" That's a piece from the show.
When did you start doing this kind of theater?
When? I'd say about 10 years ago. I was started out as a street poet with a lot of other Asian writers. We used to go all over the Bay Area and up and down California and, you know, blow our poetry to different festivals, community groups, colleges, San Quentin Prison, a lot of different places. And about 7 years ago, I started acting in, at the Asian American Theater Company in San Francisco. And putting the two together, we put this show together, staged poetry and whatever things you can use as theater to enhance the writing for the show.
I get the impression from some of your performance, which I've seen an excerpt of through videotape, mm-hmm. that in California, when you were a teenager there, that you really felt in the middle of black and white culture and were kind of not quite part of either.
Yeah, I guess San Francisco's it's not a big town, you know, it's a city, but it geographically it's only so many square miles, and it has a good mixture of people, and when you grow up in the city, you kind of grow up with everybody. You grow up with whites, you grow up with blacks, you grow up with Chicanos. And there's Chinatown, there's J-Town. It's like any other city, but you're not as spread out, say, as other towns like Los Angeles or like New York, where you know, you have huge masses in one certain area. So, yeah, in San Francisco, you do grow up with, I think, a little bit of everything. Yeah.
You were born in Hawaii.
Wahiawa, Hawaii.
Yeah, and you say there's a larger Japanese community there. Oh, what difference did that make in your life?
Well, growing up in Hawaii, Japanese, there's 77% of the population there. Everything is influenced by the Japanese, from the food, you know, to the stores, programs on TV, the radios. And that's just how the lifestyle is. And a lot of the other groups, they speak a little Japanese, you know, they know about the customs, and that's just the nature of the islands.
So do you think your attitude about being Japanese was different when you moved to California than Japanese Americans who had grown up in San Francisco was?
Well, I don't know if it was so different, but maybe I grew up a little more arrogant than some of them, just because of the fact that I never was the minority in the bigger mass. I did grow up in San Francisco too, though, so I was getting a mixture of both. And Hawaii was a nice place to go and maybe be reassured again or something, and then come back to San Francisco and get into all the hassles of youth, you know, in a city. And yeah.
Did that entail gangs?
Oh yeah, the San Francisco was full of gangs, just like any other urban situation.
Movies, they always try, well, not always, but they frequently try to integrate gangs just so it doesn't, well, I didn't say just so, but I think in part so it doesn't look like the gang is a metaphor for a certain ethnic group.
Uh-huh.
But in real life, gangs don't usually seem to be very integrated.
There are a few.
Uh-huh.
Then those are the real territorial ones, you know, guys who live with other races in a certain area, and then that's what happens. But
were you
but
in
some,
it?
Oh yeah, I was with a couple, but I guess I'm not going to say I outgrew it, because it's just that maybe some of the things that they were getting into just were going nowhere, you know, and I just had to change. I still have some friends, but you have to make some choices, I think, you know. And though they're still very good friends, yeah.
Were they racially defined gangs?
San Francisco has definitely racially defined gangs. The gangs I was in, we were pretty mixed. In fact, in the show, I talk about the gangs that I hung out with. It was a mixture of black, Asian, Chicano, and Jewish.
So Who were your models when you were growing up, both on the street and on TV? Who did you look for to find out what you were supposed to be like?
Well, I guess on TV, let's see. There are all the... I watched television like any other kid. At the movies, though, I used to go see samurai movies all the time. And I guess they were my heroes, you know. You fantasize about those times. Then again, there was always guys like Bogart, you know. And so you grow up with a mixture of people you look up to and think that are very cool or something, you know. But... And then as time goes on, I guess influences, two, if you ask me who influenced me as a writer, two of them were, one was Gil Scott-Heron and the other was Don L. Lee. Another was Lawson Inada. But I think the first two were probably two people that I loved to listen to and hear and read, although a Nicaraguan poet started me writing free verse street poetry. His name's Roberto Vargas. He's kind of a local around San Francisco.
I guess it's interesting to me that the kind of black style of poetry or of rapping would mm-hmm. be influential and would kind of help create a kind of Asian American black white mixture of, uh-huh. of influences on a writer like you.
Well, I guess it's because. One thing that happens is that, okay, there's definitely a street language, you know, and maybe the connotation that it's a black rap, you know, but it's definitely street. You know, I mean, it doesn't matter what race you are, everybody talks like that, you know. And I've even noticed it a lot more as we're traveling around and we're performing all over the United States right now and going into Chicago, going into New York. And I was just the other day we were at Washington Square and everybody there is street and they're white. They're Italian, they're Jewish, they're black, they're Chicanos, but they're all, you know, talking the same way, pretty much.
Well, did that bother the members of your family?
No, I guess a little bit, not too much. I was pretty much a real individual, I think. But my family does mean a lot to me. But they pretty much let me have my own way, yeah.
Would you perform another excerpt
sure.
of your show for us?
I'll do a piece called The Black Chap. Since we're talking about that mixture of cultures. The black Jap could be Chinese or Filipino, from LA, Oakland, or San Francisco. But this dude, he got himself a culture of his own. I mean, like his dialect don't come from Central Asia on a slow boat. No, it got itself a tempo, from Hunters Point to Manila Town, from Kearney and Jackson to Fillmore and Post. It got itself a tempo. It moves with the city. Stop and go up and down, it moves with the city. I mean, like, the black Jap is definitely cool. Yeah, this San Francisco sensei be 5 inches taller than the last census of the average Asian. He be quick-stepping all over town. 4-inch heels on them two-tone pant leather platforms from the dungeon when they were on sale. Knee-high pimp socks, his head be bobbing up and down in time to the beat of his walk. The sleeves on his black midi leather had to be shortened, but he still be cool. Smoke cools and hustle pool and rainy days of dull Wednesday nights. He was definitely cool. His pushing pimp shade sliding down his nose. Right hand in his pocket mixing with his chum change. Left hand snapping in rhythm with the bob of his head. Chewing on some doublemint. Leave a clean taste, cause tobacco can be mean on your rap. And his rap was smooth, smooth as a silk kimono. He was definitely cool. And he would cruise only the crowded streets with a top down on his 911S or low riding in his black on black Eldorado. Tint electric window, diamond tuck and roll, Keystone Mags, fat L60s in back, giving his short a slant. Finished off with yellow teardrops. He was definitely cool. He was definitely bad. He was so bad, he wore his shades in the movies. He was so bad, he ate hot links with Daikon. He was so bad, he drank Johnny Walker Black Label for breakfast. He was so bad, when Hirohito came to town, he pissed on a U.S. flag. He was so bad, he washed all segments of Roots in a dashiki. He was so bad, he could outscratch a Jimbo. He was so bad, he could do a jump kick without jumping. He was so bad, he woke up Saturday mornings to watch Asians Now and Soul Train. He was so bad, he committed harakiri. And lived. He was definitely cool. And this is the black Jap rap, so what it is, Mr. Asian America? You know, you're looking mighty sharp in your suit and tie. You must be some kind of a business executive. I bet you the chief clerk of Wells Fargo solid gold savings accounts. Well, don't tell me you sell dozens at J-Town Center. Ah, whatever. You know, I'm tired of listening to all of you searching for your soul, Asians. Don't you know where your identity is? Mine was sliced raw and thin, dipped in wasabi and spit out with the trash because the texture wasn't right. You dig what I mean? Some of you all be going around blowing each other away. When you gonna recognize the fact that we all in this together?
We all oppressed. Ain't no white man gonna give you anything without giving you any shit. They don't get colored folk, then you colored whether you like it or not. Man, you've been hassled since you got here, Japan Jack. You can't change what you are. You can't live in no dream. So take a look at yourself and take it back to the beginning and ask yourself what it is to be Asian in America. Yeah, the black Jap could be Chinese, a Filipino, from LA, Oakland, or San Francisco. But this dude, he got himself a dual culture. One of his people and one of his own. Thank you.
Lane Nishikawa performing an excerpt of his one-man show, Life in the Fast Lane, Requiem for a Sansai Poet. Well, you have connections to your past,
mm-hmm.
and also both feet firmly planted in the present.
Uh-huh.
How do you feel about like the traditions of like Japanese traditions and your role in preserving them or passing them on to other generations?
Oh, well, I feel very strongly about it. I grew up in a small town in Waihewa, in Hawaii. Waihewa was, you know, like a couple streetlights, one main drag. You know, it was like any small town out over here. And the only difference was that everybody was Japanese. And my grandparents, who raised me as a young kid, came from Japan. So they brought over, you know, the language. They brought over all the cultural aspects. And when I was over there, there was all the festivals they used to go on yearly, where there's the spring festival or the fall festival, the Obon dances, which is like a festival for the dead, the New Year's festivals, all of the cultural differences, I guess, that are set into the Japanese. And it's over here too, you know, wherever there's a large Japanese American population, I think that a lot of these things are still carried out. I performed at many of these festivals in San Francisco for years, and it was maybe my own way of putting my respect in, you know, for that. As far as helping to preserve it, I'll pass it on to my kids for sure. But also, some of the things I write, I don't include them in the show, but some of the things I write are designed for the kids, you know, which speak of these different times, like the New Year's, some of the different traditional, all these little things that you have to do when the New Year comes around. And that's what the some of the pieces I've written speak to. And I try to do it in a way where the kids will, you know, learn something, but also be entertained at the same time. Pretty much like the show, where poetry can entertain you, but also make you think.
I think it's really a riddle for people of different cultures whose roots don't begin in the United States. How to keep some of that heritage and
yeah.
live in the modern world mm-hmm. in America at the same time, particularly if you weren't born in another country. Your mm-hmm. your culture is pretty much what you grew up with in
yeah.
San Francisco or Philadelphia or New York
right.
or wherever. So uh-huh. it is, I think, a real riddle for people.
Yeah.
I guess it's one you're trying to address in your work.
Yeah, it is. It is, definitely. Couple of the pieces definitely speak to not forgetting who you are, you know, and sure that you can, and you can make it in society as whatever, you know, doctor, lawyer, teacher. But one thing that you don't want to forget is where you came from and what brought you here, what made you, what people don't let you forget who you are anyway.
What's the difference between the different generations? Are those clear-cut?
Sure, they are. The first generation comes over here, and they bring all of the... they probably don't speak a lot of English, you know. At least I'll give you my example, my family. My grandparents came over back in the 1900s, 1906, worked in the sugarcane plantations over in Hawaii. That's how a lot of them were lured over. My grandfather came over first, and from my grandmother, who was a picture bride, and they were married and lived in on Oahu. They spoke very little English. They spoke to me almost always in Japanese. So when I was a kid, my Japanese was a lot better, you know. After they died and passed away, and I didn't live with them, I lived in San Francisco. I I forget, you forget a lot of language that you don't use. You know, if you use it, you'll remember. If you don't use it, you know. My parents are a little different. They grew up, you know, after the war, after a lot of the hassles about the concentration camps came down. And example, my uncle's in the, what was in the 442nd, and my father was in the 100th Battalion. They fought for the United States. One thing about Hawaii is they didn't have to put them in concentration camps because they're on an island, you know, whereas the Japanese over here were all put into concentration camps. One of the pieces in the show is about my uncle, who, it's a very, well, it's probably the toughest piece for me to do in this show because it's about what he went through going over to Germany, fighting for the United States with all of his friends and just watching them die, you know, one by one. And then coming back over to Hawaii after the war and trying to make it. And he just had a real hard time and eventually committed suicide. And the second generation, there was a lot of, you know, that need to be patriotic to show that they weren't traitors. They would show that they weren't, I mean, they were getting dumped on all after Pearl Harbor on, you know. My father was there at Pearl Harbor. He saw, you know, all the bombs dropping, you know. And it wasn't the same Japanese that were living on the island that did it. But, of course, you know, the United States, they had their say about it. And it made for a lot of pressure, I think, was put on the third generation now, you know, to do well, you know, to make it in this world so that they won't think of you as who you are, but what you do, and be very good at it. And that was a heavy pressure, I think, amongst the Sansei generation. So my father looks at me, what, you could be a writer? What are you going to, you know, doctor, you know. But that's one of the, I think, traditional breakdowns, if you look at the three generations. And then they're the kids now, the real young Yonsei coming up now. And Jesus, I don't know what the world holds for them. Yeah.
Do you have any sense of what your peers are expecting of their children?
I see two different things. Uh-huh. I see two. One is that there's that ongoing of making a living in the United States and doing well. And the other I see are some Sanseis who don't want them to, they'll send them back to like a language school or send them back to Japan or take them and raise them where there's a lot of Japanese so that they don't forget a lot of things, you know, like that's, there's that thing about the J-Towns now around the country where they can move out in the suburbs. You know, the only time they come back into the city is to go shopping, you know. But there are some cities and neighborhoods that, you know, they bring the children. They keep them in daycare centers where there's a Buddhist priest. And they're around a lot of Japanese children just like themselves, you know, and along with new immigrants coming in. Just so that they grow up around it and it'll be implanted in them, I think. That's not, maybe not to forget a lot of things. Yeah.
Do you think there's much of a bond between the Japanese American community and the newly arriving immigrants from, say, Vietnam or recently arrived from Korea?
A difference?
No, much of a connection.
A connection?
Much of a bond.
I'll tell you. Maybe with the Koreans, there's more of a connection because the language is a lot closer. A lot of Koreans speak Japanese. There's a lot of animosity, though, because of the wars that happened. I mean, it's the same thing, right? The Japanese from Japan, you know, they were heavy dudes. They were all over the place. You know, the Philippines, when they were in Korea, they had war with China. They had war with everybody, you know? And so, like I have Chinese friends where their parents, you know, kind of don't want their daughter to go out with a Japanese guy, you know, because of some of the things that happened. Filipino families too, Korean. But there is definitely a closeness, I think, amongst the Asian people. The Vietnamese, I don't know a lot of Vietnamese, so I can't comment honestly on that because I just don't know a lot of people from Vietnam. You know, I know a lot of guys have fought over there, but, you know, not a lot of guys that came over here after, you know, all the problems and had to get out.
Poet and performer Lin Nishikawa is my guest. What are some of the new stereotypes of Japanese Americans now? Are there new ones that have replaced the old ones?
New ones? Yeah, there are. I guess in the show I do a piece about the media and about the different the changing of stereotypes almost, I guess. One of the things I notice a lot now is the fact that a lot of news programs have to have an Asian woman. Another thing that you see a lot of is sushi bars, real popular. There's got to be 800 of them in LA alone, you know?
Do you want to do that piece for us?
Sure. I'll do the piece and then we can talk about it. this piece is called Japanese Junkies. Shogun and Mifune are hot on the media meat market nowadays. Daikon and Takenoko will be on the shelves of Safeway next to Kikkoman, Ajinomoto, and Datsun Gold Editions. Japanese junkies are sprouting up like locusts. Hey, you can feel them walking by, wishing for heritage. Wishing for a new deal. Wishing for better than almost dull. Wishing their lives had color. You know, just wishing. And you can feel them wondering if Bruce Lee was Japanese or Chinese or your sensei. Wondering if, hey, that's a sword in your pocket. Wondering if you're really that good. You know, just wondering. And then you can feel them stripped naked in front of your eyes. Stripped naked and accept. Stripped naked and come out of your past. Lord Toranaga has spoken. Japanese junkies are sprouting up like locusts. And they've always been here, waiting for the right time. Sushi bars are full of yellowtail shipped in from Japan. And Hakujin vegetarians poke the eyes of Ika and Tako. Haven't you ever had octopus? With a little sweetened miso? A touch of sake? Or barbecued over hot coals on the beach? And made in Japan doesn't mean a cheap imitation throughout your childhood. Well, made in Japan had replaced by Hong Kong, Korea, and hopefully Houston, Texas. Yeah, Shogun and Mifune are hot on the media meat market nowadays. Kurosawa reruns will cost a little extra this year. And Realm of the Senses will hit the theaters once again, even though it's been censored in Japan. And television specials on Buddhist monks raking sand will end a series on Japanese culture. You know, it took hundreds of years to get the beads of sweat just right on those bald heads so housewives in Ohio will have something to chat about over afternoon tea. And hey, lady, you know in Japan, shakuhachi is slang for giving head. Hey, you think about that the next time you want to get a few notes out of that ancient bamboo flute. And hot tubs are just pop culture's revised furuba. You know, my grandfathers had cockroaches the size of your thumb running past your peripheral vision, keeping you company along with the steam. And born-again Buddha buddies have found themselves yin and yang on the way to Zen in the promised land. Yeah, Japanese junkies are sprouting up like locusts. And they've always been here, and now is the right time. Japanese women have forgotten Japanese men, or they remember how their fathers used to be. Who can blame them? Japanese men are too busy trying to make an extra yen. Pretty soon, all the colors are going to blend. And white men are sucking up anything slanted. And they haven't even been through World War II on leave in Tokyo. And the names aren't William Holden or Marlon Brando. And Susie, your son is going to need more than a letter of introduction. Your son is going to need you to remember. Yeah, Shogun and Mifune are hot on the media meat market nowadays. Asian women compliment balding, pot-bellied newscasters along with black ex-jocks and Playboy bunnies.
Hey, we compliment everybody. MASH refugees, soap opera walk-ons, constipated cops, Blade Runner derelicts, all the Katos and Katos you can eat. Even punk rock is turning Japanese. Even Hiroshima is turning jazzy. Even Time Life Books is turning kamikaze. Even Nakadai is turning good guy. Even Chinese is turning Japanese. Even Japanese is turning Japanese. Even Conan learned the way of the Bushido. Even Samurai Night Fever is killing John Belushi. Yeah, Shogun and Mifune are hot. But unfortunately, Anjin-san will always be the star. Samurai! Some will lie, and some will die. Thank you.
Lei Nishikawa has been my guest, and he's based in San Francisco, where he's a performer with the Asian American Theater Company and also performs with the Sensei Theater Company. And he'll be performing Life in the Fast Lane, Requiem for a Sensei Poet, tomorrow night, and this will be at the Annenberg School Theater. And for more information, you can call 898-6701. That's on the Penn campus. That's 898-6701. The performance again tomorrow night at the Annenberg School Theater. Thanks again for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to 91 FM WUHY in Philadelphia, and this is Lester Young. Thank you. Lester Young performing Blue Lester, and this is Fresh Air. It's 3 minutes after three, and you're tuned to 91 FM. In about an hour from the NPR Journal series, we'll be featuring a half-hour edition of Communique on the subject of spying, modern technology used in spying, and some of the recent spy scandals. At 4:30, we'll hear from astronaut Robert Crippen, who flew the first space shuttle, and another space shuttle flight is scheduled to be launched next Thursday. Actress Vivica Lindfors is currently performing a one-woman show in Philadelphia called Anna, the reflections of a Swedish-American woman in her 90s. Vivica performs Wednesday through Saturday this week and next at the Wilma Theater. Well, coming up, we're going to hear an interview that I recorded with Vivica Lindfors last spring when her autobiography, Vivica, Vivica, was published. Lindfors was born in Sweden in 1929, and after becoming a star in Sweden, she was offered a contract with Warner Brothers Films in America. She was brought to the States, where the studio hoped to fashion her into the next Ingrid Bergman, but that image didn't work. Her first American film, Night Unto Night, was completed in 1946, and she co-starred with Ronald Reagan. Her other films include To the Victor, The Adventures of Don Juan, I Accuse, King of Kings. And she also has more recent appearances like Girlfriends and, Welcome to L.A. and A Wedding. In the 70s, she toured her popular one-woman show called I Am a Woman. She'll be performing in Philadelphia Wednesday through Sunday of this week and of next at the Wilma Theater, and I'll have more information on that performance a little bit later. Coming up, this is an interview I recorded with her last spring after her book was published.
I had already two careers in a way. I mean, I started out as a young actress at the Royal Dramatic Theatre School. I was first a student in the school, and in order to get in there, you have to audition together with a lot of other people, and you're being chosen. And once you're being chosen, the school is supported by the state, and you go in the school for 3 years, and then if they want to keep you, you have to stay another 2 years as an actress. Already my second year was I given the part of a